Welcome to Season 10, Episode 13 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk about games and game mechanics that were, well, slightly ahead of their time. Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 13 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this episode is Chris and Ish. Welcome, gentlemen.
Greetings.
Good to be here.
Yeah, you know, this is one I've kind of had on my pegboard for a while, if you will, and I don't know why I always kind of like it, because it's like, as an old gamer, I've played lots of different games and with lots of different systems, and it is always, to me, it is interesting how there are games out there that had certain mechanics that were not very popular when they came out, but yet years later, there's a lot of those similar mechanics out in games that people play every day. You know? So I thought, it's always interesting to see, you know, granted they're not always identical, but it's amazing the influence, and it's just like, almost like, in some cases, it takes somebody else to come up with the same idea for it to break through, if you will. So, I guess I'll begin with one of my, I won't say personal favorites, but one of the ones that oddly I own, that I still own the rule book for, and I was flipping, this is where this, you know, this kind of came from. I was flipping through it the other day. So, way back when, I don't know, either one of you guys ever heard of Bard Games?
Familiar, but I can't say I'm super familiar with it.
Yeah, old time. Short history is that they started off making supplements for D&D, where they would have the complete spellcaster, the plea alchemist, the complete adventurer.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting, and of course, is that at some point, I don't know, one of them decided, hey, let's make our own game system that uses some of those elements. So they came up with this. The rule book was I always pronounce it Arcanum. It was part of a, they called their set of books, which there was the rule book, there was like a world guide, and there was like a monster manual, if you will. They called it the Atlantean Trilogy, because it was three books. You know, and they're some sort of fantasy Earth setting is basically early Earth, you know, type of setting. So there was all those weird fantasy versions of various, you know, Earth cultures, if you will, in it. But, you know, most of the time, I don't think I've ever played it with those elements. I think I've always just used the rulebook itself when I did play it. But one of the things that, it's the first time that, I don't know if it appeared elsewhere, but it's the first time I ever saw it in print, was saving throws based off attributes. Because, you know, I mean, let's see. I just went to go pull it off the shelf, because this was published in, the first edition was published in 1984. And if you think about that for a minute, that is way long before, you know, obviously, editions of D&D did the same. Now, I think some people had house rules for a while around that time about that. But this is the first time I think I saw it in print. I may be wrong. I mean, it may have appeared in other games. But for me, gaming at the time, that was the first time that I saw that. And they actually had something else that was unique. Perception as an attribute, not a skill. So player characters would have a perception attribute, and obviously anything perception related would be a save against your perception, rather than, you know, a skill in perception, which, I don't know. I mean, that's one of those weird ones, but I think they actually had a set of eight attributes so that people couldn't claim, well, you're just doing D&D. They added, like, two attributes.
Yeah, and considering perception scores or even attributes or anything like that, it usually were host ruled in, well, you know, you had the 1d8 check, but it didn't become kind of a skill until like third edition. Yeah, it's ahead of its time.
Yeah, you know, I mean, even the saves. You know, it's like they standardized attributes, all the attributes had saves. And matter of fact, the Arcanum eventually morphed into the parts of it, kind of morphed into the rule set that was used for versions of Talislanta. I don't know if you've heard of that game.
I have heard of Talislanta, yeah.
First published by Bard Games, then published by Wizards of the Coast.
Nice.
And then eventually, of course, you know, Wizards of the Coast was acquired D&D because they had Magic the Gathering, D&D, what TSR, you know, it's, I mean, that's a whole topic for another discussion. It's just, it's always, you know, as much as I personally have never cared for collectible card games, I would be remiss if I didn't admit that if it wasn't for Magic the Gathering, a lot of RPG companies probably would have went out of business at a certain point.
That's true.
Not even disagreeing in the slightest on that one.
You know, because I mean, like, I know a lot of game stores that if it wasn't for Magic the Gathering, they would have went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So, and obviously, you know, they pushed to the coast, got D&D, and then, you know, almost like a D&D renaissance happened because of that. So, but, so, back to, obviously, interesting game mechanics. The other mechanic that is interesting is this game had skills for characters, but it was interesting in the fact that you could actually, if you didn't want to spend XP on advancement, you could actually spend XP to gain additional skills. So, like,
yeah,
your wizard that had, oh, I only have one weapon proficiency, he could spend 1,000 XP and get a different weapon proficiency.
Well, it allows for customization, that's for sure.
Right. I mean, in other aspects, it really wasn't too, you know, too exciting.
Oh, sorry.
Eh, no worries. It's always, were they calling for me? I don't know.
Exactly.
Hello?
Yeah.
So, again, probably not the world's greatest system, but it had the, obviously because it had like the Compete Alchemist and other things built in with it. Mm-hmm. I knew a lot of people that used to just love it for the alchemy rules. So that was actually one that I thought was interesting and really ahead of its time in terms of just those things. I mean, especially, like I said, like the skill attributes. I mean, not the skill attributes, but the saves. That was just something, I think, at the time that was unheard of. And it made, you know, I remember doing it, and it made it real easy. Oh, yeah, you have to make a strength check. Easy. You know, that was, I don't think that was a common thing, really, until later.
I kind of like it, actually, and I think it makes a lot of sense for customization. Like, I can see how that led to this concept, like the E8, where basically you try to stay within the sweet spot and instead just advance your character. Yeah. Or races of the original Red Box, where you only went up to a certain level, but after a point you had obscene saving throws.
Oh, one other thing that was interesting, I've never seen it duplicated anywhere, or some, I don't know if there's been something similar, but it actually had the concept of renown, how well known your player characters were. Each player character would start off between a 1 and 4% of renown, and then as you adventure, the idea was that eventually you would gain more and more renown points, and you could get over 100% renown because you could be completely well known where you're at, but, you know, on a different continent, nobody may have heard of you yet.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea for a dangling plot hook. Like, hey, we know who you are, and here's how we can make your life needlessly complicated because, you know, we want you to help you with the sheep, which you basically wanted on the field, and we need your help. You know, celebrity has a double-edged sword.
Oh, it even had rules for where you could gain 100% in, like, negative renown, basically being things like known like being, like, a coward. You know, you gain 100% renown for basically doing something bad or something not worth, really, most people, you weren't famous for doing deeds, but you were famous for misdeeds, if you will, even.
Infamy.
Infamy, yeah.
Yeah, I can argue there, and it definitely could add a certain way to actually find a way to basically generate into a mechanical benefit of some sort.
And I know I've used that in D&D, you know, just always sometimes, because it's like, that was one of those mechanics that, to me, it's like, it's really not tied to the game system, per se, so it was really easy just always, roll a d4, there's your initial renown, and just play into it. And it's funny, because there's a score for renown, people want to get renown. You know?
Like, they'll go out of their way to do it.
Yeah. It's kind of funny the way that is with players, you know? It's like, otherwise, most, I mean, I know a lot of games are like, nobody cares about being famous. Because there's no, in some ways, because there's no mechanic for being famous on a lot of systems, it's like, eh, I don't care. I'm famous or I'm not famous. It's up to the game master to decide. Okay, fair enough. But, you know, you have a set, you know, mechanic to say, hey, at least with a 50% of renown, you know, one in, you know, on average where I'm from, one in, out of every two people has probably heard of me. So.
Yeah, and then basically you can use that for guiding adventure. Yeah, and it gives you something to shoot for, you know, besides wealth and power. Because, exactly. You know, you'd be surprised what you do for fame and fortune.
So.
As far as your character is concerned.
All right, so you have one on here that you have Call of Cthulhu listed.
Yeah.
Which I do agree with. Mainly because it's like, it was one of the first systems that I ever played. Call of Cthulhu and obviously like Ruin Quest, you kind of have to, since they use the same base system. Was the first system I ever played that everything was skill based. You know, there were no levels, there were no classes. I take that back. Traveler technically is the first system that I played like that, but I'm going to say it was probably the first quasi fantasy games that I played that's the way they were. There were no classes.
Yeah. Well, Call of Cthulhu has two basic things I really consider revolutionary for the time. Like, I had a little bit of trouble, I'll be blunt, finding stuff that I didn't consider, you know, mechanics ahead of their time, per se. But with Call of Cthulhu, it's two major things. It's the exception to the power fantasy that a lot of other games that came before it were, because it literally changed your perspective of how you game. Like, your idea of surviving a Call of Cthulhu campaign is basically living through the experience. In order to do so. Additionally, you have the D100 and how you can get better if you fail miserably.
Yeah.
Well, in the game, like, which I believe they also use for RuneQuest as well. It's been a while, though.
Yeah, RuneQuest was the same basic system. Definitely, in terms of certain uniqueness, RuneQuest had the advantage of, it was the first time that I had actually saw a game that had a partial armor system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they had,
or hit locations with hit points in different physical locations.
Right, so they had, you know, hit points in different locations, and you could wear different armor, and, you know, they obviously had an encumbrance system that sort of worked. You know, and so it's like, oh, you know, you have armor on this, and it's like, you know, for people that were like, oh yeah, I could have a metal breastplate and, you know, leather arm protection or something like that. It's like, okay, that's cool. That works. You know, here's the encumbrance for that. You know, and so that was unique at the time. I don't know if hit locations truly work, but it was like one of the first games that I ever knew that had hit locations.
Mm-hmm.
So that was unique for RuneQuest, I think. And then obviously, you know, again, skill system, background was important in that game. It's like, at least in RuneQuest, because that's basically how you get all your skills.
Yeah. I also like the fact that I would argue that RuneQuest was one of the first games where everybody knew magic. Like, yes. Everybody had at least some spell. That's why you had a POW score.
Yeah, everybody had magic. That which was, honestly, bizarre in certain aspects. But then, it's amazing how they made it work. And in some ways, they almost want to make it sound, with, depending on which version of RuneQuest, I had the Avalon Hill edition. It's almost like it's magic, but it's almost not quite magic. You know? Depending on how you read it. Especially when, you know, if you're from a civilized society where you're an alkalite instead of a, you know, whatever, you know, it's like you gain some powers. That's one thing that the Avalon Hill edition of RuneQuest was definitely ahead of its time for, was religion. In terms of clerics, basically, of certain deities would get access to certain spells that clerics of other religions wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the more unique things that we've seen, obviously, in other game systems over time. And most of the time, like, I think in D&D, they didn't I think they try not to restrict you, but rather, oh, you gain access to the additional spells, and obviously we saw that in D&D flow over into, you know, the wizards who had specialties in different, you know, areas of magic, different types.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
And but there's always been kind of a bit of a dichotomy, like almost from day one, where, again, the cleric, it's not the literally the first game, but it definitely was there before... you know, before they switched over to either BESCMI or first edition AD&D. So, you know, it's, what was the, it was fighter and mage for sure. Then it was cleric, then it was thief. Is that the order the four original core classes were built? It's been a while.
You know, I don't honestly remember.
Yeah, I can't quite remember myself.
Yeah, it's been a long time. So if I'm horribly wrong, let us know. But I think that was the order that was done in originally, because you had the original walk, you know, you had the white box set originally, and then you had the brown, and then you had, I believe it was, that's when you start getting the AD&D. But that's been a long time, and it's kind of interesting just watching the changes that occurred. But
tangent. Here, one second, guys. You guys keep talking.
Okay. I think the one I'd like to bring up is... kind of the side effect of the storm. Like, I always have a bit of an interesting relationship when it comes to Judges Guild back in the 80s, where they were the first one to kind of try to wedge their way into becoming a product that was compatible with D&D as a whole. The idea of play aids, where they literally tried to push material and product so that they could kind of ride the coattails of D&D. Which is very much a predecessor to something like the OGL in D20.
Well, I was thinking, when they decided to take the thing. What was the other company? The one, because they didn't do roll aids. Yeah. Somebody else did roll aids, right?
Yeah, take a look. I'm pretty sure it was Judges Guilds, because I also know Flying Buffalo did something similar, but it's been a while.
Because I know they got. I think they got sued.
Yeah, they basically, this is where lawyers are in everything.
Roll Age was in Mayfair Games.
Mayfair Games, that's it. Okay, my bad.
Yeah.
Because I remember something like kind of a side effect product that was basically being put out as a residual within the actual, you know, basically going right up to the copyright line without going over, as at least as far as they knew, until they found it otherwise.
Right.
And,
yeah, it was just one of those things where they changed it just enough. And I mean, oh God! I mean, if you're going to go there, I'd be remiss in mentioning Ardwin.
Ardwin, yes.
You know, Dave Hargrave's stuff, because it's like, it was funny when you read the books that you had gotten for that, the original, you know, Ardwin stuff, the three booklets. It's like It kind of had mechanics that there were no. It's like. Well, there's this other game that you can supposedly get, but not really. You know, it's like, it never, it's one of those, there was supposed to be a different game system that it was for, if you will. But yeah. No one I've ever known had actually used that other game. They had used it as supplemental material for D&D. And there was some whoppingly interesting material in there. That, I mean, even today, I think was ahead of its time. One of my personal favorites had to revolve around hit points, where your hit points was your constitution plus a number based off of, I think, race, you know, and then, you know, depending on your class, you might get one to three hit points in addition per level. But even if you were 10th level, you still wouldn't have like 100 hit points. You might have 50. And the argument the argument in the article, or this little section, because it was an optional rule in this book, was that, you know, in most fantasy games, because of the way hit points work, you couldn't have a 10th level fighter fighting back-to-back with a first level fighter, because the first level fighter would just die.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That is... like, basically, again, I always think of that one legendary comic where a panic villager enters the tavern and says, "Run away, guys. There's a 20th level fighter that needs 5 experience points."
Right. Right. But also in there, because of this rule change for hit points, there was also a rule change in clerical healing. Because the idea was like, well, a first level, you know, the Cure Light Wound spell should heal 25% of your hit points. Whatever that is. So if you had, obviously, if you had, let's just use a number, let's say you had 12, you would heal, you know, 3.
Yeah.
With a healing. And then, like, the other levels of Cure Light Wound would take you up to, like, I think because they had some different deviations, you could go all the way from, like, 25, there was, like, a 25, a 50, a 75%, and, like, a 100% spell is the way they had it broken down. And I was thinking, you know, to me, both those things together always made more sense because it's like, okay, because it always sucks that earlier on a Cure Light Wound will heal a character almost completely, and then later on a Cure Light Wound will do nothing.
Yeah, it's basically a glorified Band-Aid.
Won't move the meter, if you will. So that was definitely ahead of its time. I'm actually a big fan, obviously, of Savage Worlds, where obviously wounds aren't hit points, but wounds are pretty much fixed. It's not like you get more.
Okay. Speaking of Savage Worlds, I got a weird question to ask you guys. I'm trying to think if there's an earlier example than Deadlands Classic for the idea of the chips to influence the game, or bennies, or what have you. Because obviously that's the earliest one I can find as far as, you know, putting down a physical object to basically change your bonuses. And I'm just trying to think if there's anything earlier.
No, I mean, nothing that I can think of.
The closest I can think of is, I know a lot of people used to get 30-sided dice.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would give everyone, you can roll the 30-sided die instead of your 20-sided die once per session for anything. That's about the closest I think I've ever seen to like a Benny.
Okay. Yeah, because I honestly think it's one of the most, well, again, originally it was basically designed around poker, using the chips and so forth, but they basically tried to simplify it at later points. Like, a buddy of mine managed to find a superhero game that was literally published between Deadlands Classics and Savage Worlds, and you could see the evolution in actual game design from it. I think it's called A New Frontier, but something like to that effect.
Yeah.
And it's basically a superheroes campaign that evolves between the two, so it's a concept that I'm trying to see if there's actually a predecessor or if Shane really is that brilliant, which is certainly possible considering all the stuff he's done over the years.
There may be some other precedent for it, but that's probably the close. I mean, if it is, there's not too much further back from that, I don't think. There may have been something else, but I think that's the first time that I think I've seen it. Because I'm trying to think, you know, although, in essence, things like luck points have existed prior to that.
Oh, definitely. Like, I remember the old Fighting Fantasy game books, which had luck as an ablative source. You rolled under it, but every time you did, you lost a point, so basically your luck was running out.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, I think that's the closest thing, I think, to a Benny is various games that had various luck points. Like, oh, your luck point, you can spend a luck point for a reroll, but again, like you said, it was ablative. You didn't get them every session.
Yeah.
So that's probably the closest to Benny's that I think I can think of. And I don't think that was, again, I don't think that was tied to any particular game. I think those were just somewhat optional house rules that cropped up over time. Because I don't think I've seen that. Obviously, those Fighting Fantasy game books are probably the first time I've ever heard of it in print. But I don't think I've seen it in print anywhere else.
Yeah, like, it's one of those things that you're pretty sure was done around the gaming table even as late as the 70s. But I don't know if it was ever written down. And that's kind of why I'm kind of bouncing it off these things here, because, you know, we're trying to find the dawn of time or whether or not the stuff was revolutionary and actually acknowledged or whether it happened beforehand. So, I don't know. Just food for thought at this point.
Well, you know, it's interesting that there are games that even at the beginning of the gaming industry were way unique. And I'm going to mention Traveller for that. Because Traveller was probably the first game system I ever played where players had skills versus just a class. You know, that was mind-boggling to me. And not only that, but your skills were, they gave you some bonuses, but that wasn't, even though you had skills as listed on the sheet, that really didn't completely define your character.
Oh, definitely.
You know, because definitely Traveler is one of those strange ones where, you know, oh, what did you do? I was a scout. And my whole thing is, oh, I got pilot one and something else. That's my entire skill set.
Yeah. You know? Well, you got most of your personality from Traveler from your background.
Right.
When you know, the crazy table, because that's how you defined him.
Right. And I mean, in some ways, that was way ahead of its time.
Oh, absolutely. I will stand by Traveler has one of the greatest backgrounds of all time, even if you could die through it. Like, for all our jokes of that, it's kind of cool knowing you have this epic backstory even before you start.
Well, not only that, but Traveler was definitely one of the first games where I know as a player, I play someone that was usually over 40. That was unheard of, you know. Usually, you play, you know, I mean, talking human-wise, you play a character and you're like, they're 19, 20 or something stupid like that.
Yeah, it's the quintessential zero from two hero, you know, hero's journey, which was basically emulated by the original D&D.
Yeah. But, you know, and, I mean, Traveler was the first game where it's like, oh, yeah, 38-year-old, 40-year-old, wow. You know, and it's like, I, as an older guy myself, sometimes it's like, fuck, I wish I would have gotten as many skills as some of these guys gotten 5 terms of service.
Yeah.
Where the hell's my mustering out benefits? Where's my scoutship?
Definitely. Well, it's a different space and a different world.
Yeah.
Okay, I would be remiss if I didn't mention a game that got great success 15 years later after it was completely repackaged. I, of course, am referring to Fudge.
Oh, yeah.
Fudge did a lot. They even tried to build a system called the Interlock. Everybody's familiar with Cyberpunk 2020 and 2013 and all that. But it wasn't until considerably later that when Fred Hicks tried to do Spirit of the Century, where we defined it more of a story type system, that it became popular. And I would argue that, well, kudos among other things, but he had to literally redo it because the original Fudge system did use a lot of conventions during the time. But the core of the system is still more or less intact. But things change over time.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, obviously Fate and Fudge Dice are the same thing. D6s, but with, you know, two pluses, two minuses, two blank sides.
Absolutely.
You know, and that still throws people. And it's, and I forget what, I remember somebody telling me, it's like, they don't like playing games where there's, you need all these specialty dice. And I'm like, you know, specifically, usually they're referring to what Dungeon Crawl Classics or Mutant Crawl Classics, because there's some additional dice in there that most people don't have in their set. But I still find it amusing. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's what we said about D&D. There's all these funky little dice.
Well, dude, we never got a D10 until like the late 80s.
Yeah. I remember taking my crayon and doing the D20.
But then there used to be just the D20s that were just like 1 through 10 twice.
Yes, that's what I mean. You'd have to take your crayon and you would actually color one set of 10 one color and another set of 10 a different color. You know, I think it's on a lot of the dice it was like white and red. I think is what I typically used, or was it white and black, depending, you know. Hell, I mean, there were editions of the game where nobody even got dice. They just got chits.
Mm-hmm.
So
I hear that's how they play it in prison.
That wouldn't surprise me because, you know, it's funny. There are a lot of prisons that actually have outlawed D&D because it might be a form of gambling.
Right. Yeah, there's all kinds of... It's a big controversy, but that could be its own episode probably.
Yeah.
But no, it's funny about Fudge and now Fate. Like, Fudge is what I wrote my first role-playing supplement for, or at least under that rule set. So it's kind of near and dear to me for that reason. But it's funny now that, like, the supposed, like, super simple system, I was trying to pull out Fate the other day, and it's like 250 pages of rules.
Yeah.
It's not as simple as probably it could be. But that being said, I have a couple of ideas for like things that were ahead of their time, but for me, it's always going to be the fusion system, the Artel-Saurian life path system. They've got this whole chart, and I know that it wasn't necessarily a new thing. There were other things where you like roll for your background. This is your character.
Well,
but it was
The original Cyberpunk game, the one I have both. I have the Anyway, the original Cyberpunk, it actually had that life path system where that was that kind of generated your background. So
and it was the first one that, at least that I noticed, that was not system specific. You could use that for anything. I did. I would use that for like just about any game because there was nothing in that life path that was that tied you to a system. There was it was fairly system agnostic.
Yeah,
And I just remember so many people after that basically using the same idea.
Yeah, because I think the life path in the original Cyberpunk game was a little specific. So
yeah,
but I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, those ideas are nothing new. People have been trying to generate those type of systems for a long time. I've never actually saw the one in the Fusion version, so I really can't comment on how agnostic it was.
Well, and it was very general. Like, there was nothing about technology. It was just like, oh, this is the order you were born in. This is a thing that happened to you in your childhood. Like, it might be like your parents died, but nothing about it like was specific to a setting, a system, or anything like that. These are things that could happen to virtually anyone, unless you're playing some kind of a really weird sci-fi game where, like, you know, basic concepts don't apply. But yeah. I might have to shoot that to you guys because it's one of my go-tos. It's one of my favorite things to just that life path.
I think the original Cyberpunk life path, I think, gave the character skills. I don't remember completely, so that's probably. That's probably why when they went Fusion, they kind of divorced it, made it more generic.
Mm.
So.
Okay. I got another question here. When was the earliest time when you had 1 to 2 pages adventures? Because we definitely have gone to a point where we're trying to go for, you know, we kind of go from lumping and splitting when it comes to adventure concepts and ideas. Like, a lot of the original D&D was basically, here's a dungeon, here's some random monsters, go have fun jams. And then we kind of went through an evolution of the story path. Then we went through the adventure path concept, or the multiple modules. And then we kind of also went through a truncation again, where we basically had the idea of, like, Savage Worlds, you got one page. Use it wisely.
You know,
and
if you want my opinion?
Sure.
I'm going to go with Traveler.
Okay.
And the only reason I say that is if anyone who has ever read 76 Patrons will know, it's just, here's a patron, here's like 3 possibilities of the venture, go for it, do the rest. So it didn't have like, I mean, it had enough for you to run an adventure if you were quick on your feet, but it didn't have everything. But I would say that would be the genesis of, you know, to me, of like a one-page adventure, because you just write some notes on a sheet of paper and there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was, it's like, you have all the other books. You don't need, you know, oh, I need statistics for these. I have some other books that give me statistics for some bad guys. Who cares? You know?
Yeah.
You had all those, you know, they had a lot of supplements. So, yeah, I mean, I would say that that's probably the first time I've ever seen that format. And actually, when you get into like the old Journal of the Traveler's Aid Society, they would have adventures that wouldn't be more than like 3 pages. Again. Mm. So I would say Traveler, but Traveler was the anomaly.
Yeah.
But post that, I would say definitely, you know, Savage Worlds is where I've seen that again. And sometimes I hate it because it's like, there's this adventure, and it's like there's one encounter in the entire adventure, and there's just some other background, and that's really the adventure? Really? I don't know if I'm going to have to add some water to this and do some other things, because there's just not enough material here.
It's kind of like finding the balance, like literally where there's enough material that you can run an adventure, but it's still really compact for you to just fiddle with, like Palladium's Hook, Line, and Sinkers, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Or the Well, one of the podcasts I somewhat listen to is Happy Jack's RPG podcast, where they actually keep, they ran a couple of, you have one page adventure, explain everything. And it's been really intuitive seeing some of these contests, the ones they actually publish, and what they are able to publish and so forth. And I guess I'm just trying to figure out where the rabbit hole goes. As well,
I was just going to say, I remember, and I can't remember the company. I don't want to know if it was like Goodman Games or Fantasy Flight Games. But right there at the early dawn of third edition D&D, they had those pamphlets. They were literally like these trifold, like cardstock pamphlets with an adventure. And it was kind of an in-between. It was, I think they used smaller print to get more stuff on there, but it was like, here's the premise. Here's some like, encounter designs. Here's about two or three encounters that you'll go through, and here's the story that you need to kind of, the story beats that you need to hit. And those seemed like a pretty good idea. I think the downside to them were that after a while they were just literally trying to shovel them out as fast as they could, and so I couldn't speak necessarily to the overall quality, but the idea was there, and it was fairly interesting.
Yeah, I know, was it, I think it was AEG did that for SpyCraft.
That might have been the company. I think it was AEG who did that for D&D.
Specifically, with SpyCraft was their Living SpyCraft campaign that they had for a while, where, you know, they would, these pamphlets, you couldn't, you know, they would give them out for, like, these Living SpyCraft sessions that people would do at stores. And eventually they allowed you to, they had downloads where you could download them. But that's where... You know, and that's actually, you know, I've used several of those adventures for SpyCraft because, yeah, there's just a few pages and the players get involved and do whatever. And there were some stinkers in there, if you ask me. But there were some, but there were some winners, too. You know, depending on how crazy you wanted to get. I mean, I liked the idea of SpyCraft because I remember I wanted to run a spy game, but I did not want to run... The options, I think, at the time were, you know, either SpyCraft or D20 Modern. You know, for the people I was playing with. And I remember looking at D20 Modern and, like, D20, it's not a bad system, but, you know, when your character class is strong hero, that doesn't fucking describe much to me.
No.
You know, it was lacking a lot, where it's like, okay, well, this makes sense. So this guy's, you know... Some sort of military fighter. You have the face man. You have the guy that's the wheel man. Great. This people can grasp that and like that. So.
Well, types. Yeah, I got a real love-hate relationship with Modern D20. I both hate it and drew a ton from it for my own analysis. Like, stuff like talents need to be more powerful than feats, which ultimately is kind of what they did. They kind of basically made the powers more important than the characters in both 4th and 5th edition. So you could definitely tell they were able to learn from their mistakes. And the fact that you have to have a build before you even get started, because you could have 5 levels of strong, 3 levels of gunslinger, and 2 levels of epic gunslinger in order to get a certain particular archetype, whereas it's easier just to start from the ground up. But I got a real love-hate relationship with the purchase value system in particular. It's both one of the most brilliant things they've ever done and one of the things people hate the most about Modern D20. Yet, paradoxically, I'd argue that it almost works better in 5th edition than ever did in 3rd. Because, you know, it makes it easier to figure out which, what, you know, whether or not you can access this equipment or that equipment.
Yeah, well, honestly, I don't care. 5th edition, 3.5, I can't comment on 4th. Any of those, even 4th, whatever. Especially 3.5. You know, it's with a lot of, actually, even the D20, I mean, especially SpyCraft. SpyCraft was the 2nd edition, which I like the concept of, but to me, it's just like the feat tree was insanity on a whole new level. I swear, you know, the Necronomicon and Call of Cthulhu has nothing on that rulebook. You know, in terms of just sanity loss by reading it.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing there. You know, here. There are certain elements.
Know, I mean, I love the idea that, okay, you get equipment picks, and it's like, but the equipment system, even the, it's funny, even the edition I had, which was an improvement apparently over the old system, was still, I mean, I swear they made the assumption that people, it's like, you didn't want to change equipment between adventures because it took you too fucking long. Not to mention the fact that most people didn't have, because of the way the system was, most people didn't get guns. You know, which, it's like, I remember when we played, one of the players always ended up with the feet bag full of guns. That way, at least everyone could get something. You know, you always had a character that had bag full of guns, so you could, like, what'd you get? I don't know, I got this crappy 38 revolver, or I got this crappy Russian piece of junk, but hey, at least I got a weapon I can use on this adventure.
Yeah.
You know, and mm-hmm. you're just like, really? Because at first level, nobody got any equipment, really. And you're like, well, that's no fun. So, but yeah, the feet trees, that got to be insanity, and just, I don't know, dealing with the system in general was harsh. I liked the concept of a spy game, and that just, that definitely took the fight out of me on that one. So.
Yeah. Don't blame me on that one, that's for sure. Okay.
Getting back on topic, though, of things that were kind of ahead of its time, I'm going to go with Rollmaster.
Yeah.
Now, they took it to an extreme, but first system that ever had criticals that I could remember.
Yeah.
You know.
Like, no, criticals were always one of those fun house rules that when I first started gaming that everybody used, but that was second edition D&D as far as that's concerned. So,
right.
Yeah. Oh, I bet you basically took the concept and said, ooh, that's shiny.
Yeah. Well, of course, everyone looked at it. Oh, these critics are great and funny, and the fumbles are funny, but it's very complex to use. You know, people always used to call Rollmaster Chartmaster. And I will I will argue that if you just take the original RM2 rules at its heart, it's not that hard of a system. You know, basic system is your roll percentile dice, you add your modification. Yeah, you kind of half the time need a calculator, big deal. And, you know, you know, in terms of when you attack someone, you roll your dice, add your weapon, you know, pluses, subtract their defensive bonus, and then you consult the stupid-ass chart with all the weapons. That said, I think they had too many weapon charts. And depending on what, you know, if you play something like the original Middle-earth role-playing game, you know, they combined all that stuff into like four or five charts. That was it. And sometimes I think that's what they needed to do. They needed to stop doing all these specialty things. And if you played Space Master, which was the space version of the game, I think that's where all of a sudden it's like, well, this is easy. You know, I have a blaster. It's a Mark II blaster. It stops at this point in the table. Done. You know. Again, the criticals were a little hard to swallow, but I'm sorry, nothing beats like a 100 E-crush critical, ever. You know, or like the 100, I don't know if it was 100 or 66 E-pierce, where it's like shot through foe's eyes, makes it difficult for foe to live. You know? I mean, come on.
We love our cortex, especially when you feel awesome, because you pulled off a critical. Criticals are things players love to have to do and hate having done to them.
Well, it was also the first system I ever played that had bleeding as an option. You know, that said, again, there was lots of that system that were really complicated, and you're just like, okay, whatever. So, but that was the first system that had that. First system, I think, that I played where people had background options. You know, where there was actually options to roll on the table where you could actually, like, get special equipment because of your background. Like, mm-hmm. you could get... And it was, like, the first system where there were magic weapons and non-magic weapons of quality. So you could get a non-magic weapon that might, you know, because it was percentage, would give you a plus 10% to hit.
Yeah.
But didn't make it magical. It was just a better, high-quality weapon.
Well, again, we live in a culture where you had things like Toledo steel at one point, so it makes perfect sense that there'd be higher quality equipment.
Right. So, but I mean, okay. I think in that, you know, especially with that type of system where, you know, it was very easy to, because it was a percentile system, a plus five is obviously just like a plus one on a D20 system. It's not that bad. And I think even items of quality, I think, only went up to like plus 10 or plus 15. So it wasn't until you got into the magic items, I think, you could get up to plus 50 or higher. But then, again, with the way that system worked, where, you know, you could face an opponent that had a 200 defensive bonus, you had to roll, sometimes had to roll pretty high. So.
Yeah,
just
definitely.
Again, food for thought. Oh, that and because of the size of a creature, certain criticals didn't exist. It's like you had, so if the creature was large, I think three of the criticals didn't affect it because you had to actually get a D or an E critical to even hurt it. And then even when you did, you rolled on a different table.
Yeah, it's reminding me of Galaxy Quest. Aim for the vulnerable parts. It's a rock and it has no vulnerable parts.
Great movie. Aren't they? I don't remember. Darn, weren't they supposed to do a series or are still doing a series?
I've heard both.
Yeah.
Like, I know that when Alan Rickman died, they kind of put it on the back burner, but I heard it's moving again, so...
Well, I didn't think that the original cast was even going to be involved in a TV series anyway.
Yeah, but it's going to be a hard act to follow when you have both Rickman and Weaver on the same cast.
Yeah, well, that and I'll be a blunt now that you kind of have, not that it's the same premise, but you have like that show The Orville floating around. It's kind of like, well, this is the last thing I need to do, which is a science fiction series that's funny.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that kind of pollutes the water just a little bit.
Yeah. Going back to one of our original things we talked about, I've read that it's been argued that the basic role-playing game, which was made in 1980, that's the basis for both Call of Cthulhu and RuneQuest, is the first generic role-playing system. Although, you know, basically a predecessor to GURPS, which is a completely setting independent game in its commercial, you know, for its actual design. And if that's true, then it really was the trendsetter for that concept, the idea. You have your set of rules, and then you adjust them accordingly.
Yeah, that's interesting, because, I mean, I'm trying to think of... Because when did Champions come out? Well, yeah, because Champions, the first system of Champions came out in 1981. And I know after that they had things like, you know... what eventually became Danger International, which was their spy version of the game, and some other things. But it's true, you know, now that I think about it, the basic system eventually had, you know, was used for things like Superhero 2044.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I guess technically that would be considered probably one of the most, the original, if not a generic game, a generic rule set.
Yeah, maybe they just kept it under, you know, in-house, and then they just modified them based on their needs. Whereas, I'm going to turn it around a little bit here. There's a lot in the latest indie movement where you make a game based on a concept, an idea, something you're trying to emulate. And they're definitely going into some areas that gaming doesn't normally go. Like 12 Candles, where you basically light candles during the apocalypse, and you basically role-play the scenario, kind of more of a storytelling-type system. And I guess I'm trying to figure out if there's a game that was more storytelling-orientated in that manner than World of Darkness, because that's the earliest one that's coming to me. Even though it wasn't quite right, but it was also one of the most popular, for setting that up.
I'm gonna say, because if I'm not, I might be crazy, but did not Amber Diceless come out before Vampire?
Good question. Let's find out.
You know, that would be true.
But
it did, because that, I mean, I remember Amber way before I ever heard of World of Darkness.
And I think it's one of those things where I would have to say Amber probably was the first one to do that, but Vampire was the first one to popularize it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless there's something else that came before that I can't think of.
Yeah, because, well, Amber Diceless came out, it says, in 1991.
Mm-hmm. And literally the same year, so it's possible. I'm not going to lie to you there either way.
It's close.
Yeah.
But the zeitgeist was there. People wanted something that was less granulated and more story focused.
Oh, definitely. And again, I've been a fan of James Burke for quite some time, and I believe in connection. Sometimes things happen because everybody, you know, there's a demand that we don't know about until somebody defines it, and it's only a matter of time before somebody defines it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, but definitely the World of Darkness books definitely push the story angle on gaming more than probably anything else I can think of, even though I'm personally not a fan over the World of Darkness setting. And it's just, it's not, and I tell people, it's like, it's not the game system. To me, it's just, I have no desire to play a werewolf. I have no desire to play a vampire. I have no desire to do any of the other settings that they have. It just doesn't interest me.
You know? But I would argue it's like, if not one of the if not the first, then one of the first urban fantasy environments. You know, other than people who play with their D&D and threw guns in there, which I'm pretty sure we all did at one point.
Right.
Okay. I'm thinking another one that might be the first as far as a genre is concerned, as opposed to a rules mechanic, Bushido, the role-playing game back in 1979.
Oh, great game.
It literally created the idea of role-playing in a country other than, you know, in Asia of the various types. Like, it's definitely quite a few years before Origins of Adventures for D&D, or Legend of the Five Rings, or Mizukuma, or what have you.
The magic system, and it was confusing and lackluster. Most people I've ever known that have played it just don't play it with magic.
Mm-hmm.
That said, has probably one of the more interesting mass combat systems I've ever played. Because I remember in that system, you know, the game master could play one side and the players could play another side. And while the guy in charge of one set of forces would just roll a dice against, obviously, the game master for certain things, every single player that was involved would have to roll in this encounter table. And ensuing in that combat, they could have just like, oh, well, you killed five people, you know, in this quasi-turn. Or there was actually a chart where it's like you would actually have to face, like, a couple of guys, and you would actually fight it out, like in the regular combat system. So it was unique to me because then all the players had investment and were involved in some way. Even though each person was in its own individual combat, it did make every person like, hey, I want to be involved in this fight because I'm not going to just sit around with my thumb at my butt. I'm actually going to do something.
That's actually a really good way to do it. And that way everybody, you know, like you said, everybody gets involved. And this blows my mind. I actually found a game older than Bushido when it comes to being an Asian role-playing game, Empire of the Petal Throne.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. That's one of the more unique. I don't know if I would call that Well, I guess it had a lot of other influence besides Oriental. I would say it's more Mesoamerican, I think, in a lot of aspects.
Interesting.
If you really get down to it, I think the professor was a big fan of the Mesoamerican cultures.
Yeah, you're right.
Which is one of those other systems that was around the same time as D&D. But any book that I've ever saw with it, I found the whatever I found completely incomprehensible.
Yeah. Well, again, there was an era where everybody wanted a chart, and this is even before Rolemaster for a lot of these things, like the original Gamma World, which is very easily the trendsetter when it comes to post-apocalypse, unless there's some weird game that I'm not aware of.
No, that's pretty much the main one that I can think of, although it depends on how you define post-apocalyptic.
Oh, nice. Yeah, because I know Aftermath came out roughly the same time, but I think it came out like 5 years later.
Gamma World, Aftermath. I'm not talking about I'm talking about even post-apocalyptic games in general. You know, you have, you know, depending, you have things like Twilight 2000, which in many ways is post-apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, like I said, to say the least. That's just one of those interesting games. You know, But yeah, definitely Gamma World is up there for that. And I think, like you said, Aftermath was around in the same time. But again, Aftermath, that was another FGU game, right? Fantasy Game Unlimited?
Here, let's find out.
Yeah, because FGU is kind of a weird little organization. Because I think they published games, but they didn't really make anything themselves originally.
The original publisher of Aftermath was Fantasy Games Unlimited in 1981.
Yeah, FGU, yeah. They're,
so,
It's actually FGU is one of the reasons that there was not a second edition of Bushido.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody, they still own the rights to Bushido at some level, which was weird because they hadn't published in years.
Yeah. So. Well, it's the same problem we have with, Villains of Vigilantes, where they were in limbo hell to the point where they had to involve lawyers in order to get back the thing before they could run their Kickstarter almost 20 years later.
Right. No, exactly, because those things shifted her up so much. And actually, an interesting little tidbit is one of the reasons that one of the game shops that we used to have here in Phoenix used to have a lot of FGU stuff was because they were either one of the people who was there was involved in FGU or knew some one of their friends was involved with FGU, so they always had a bunch of old FGU stuff floating around. So that game store no longer exists. Thank God. I still remember it's like you would go, their point of sale system was this rundown PC that the hard drive had failed, and they were running the operating system off this weird tape system that they had.
Whoa.
Ow.
Yeah. It had like this weird tape backup drive that apparently you could, with some software, you could actually use it as an actual drive. And so they actually ran their software off that drive, and so it would read and write to this tape.
You know what that's reminding me of is the old ColecoVision, not ColecoVision, VIC-20s. The Commodores.
Commodore 20s, yep.
Yeah, where you basically had to press fast forward and play and make sure you had the right tape section before you could run whatever game was on there.
Well, you know, VIC-20s had, there were a lot of early bulletin board systems that were run off VIC-20s.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Bulletin board systems.
Yeah, that one I'm going to give squarely to Steve Jackson Games. He was the first person, as far as I know, who really tried to use BBSs and therefore eventually the internet for gaming, for communications and so forth.
I actually, you know, it's funny. When I was in Portland, Oregon, back in 89, they actually, I don't know if any, have either one of you used bulletin boards before?
Fortunately, for risk of dating myself, yes.
I have. One or two. Now, Portland was unique because they had a role-playing game network for the bulletin board. So you could log into different bulletin boards and they'd have the same message bases on all those bulletin boards. And the messages would get floated around. Which was great because it's like you could log in, you could say, hey, I'm looking for this type of game, and you knew that they were going to be within the city limits.
Yeah, didn't you used to have like meetups? Like you could basically say, we're all going to be within, you know, at this bar, this time, this date, and everybody who's on the bulletin board, if you want to meet each other, you can show up.
Yeah, I mean, they used to do meetups all the time for various bulletin boards. I mean, it was kind of a very unique thing. But, so they would have this RPG network, and that's how I actually got to play quite a few games of, like, RuneQuest because of that. Because before that, hadn't met a lot of people that were really interested in RuneQuest. So did a little bit of that in Portland, and I always tell people, it's like even years later, that system to me was still much more useful because it was local than, well, you can go online and post things to try to find people. Yeah, but not really. The internet is a strange thing where everything is everywhere, but yet you're missing the localness that you sometimes need.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I agree.
You know, it's like sometimes I think Craigslist model works a little better for certain things, you know, where it's like, oh, you need to tell me where you're at so I can give you stuff that's relevant to your location.
Yeah, the biggest sign is when you need to get a gaming group together and you meet these incredibly awesome people and then you find out they're in another city.
Right. And I mean, it's tough, you know, so yeah, just a thought. Now, we also have to mention Steve Jackson Games for being one of the first people rated for by the IRS and stuff, and having their because of possible hacking concerns and things when they were writing their cyberpunk game.
I still love that story. Sorry, go on.
So, I mean, geez, I mean, I think it took the, I don't think they ever, I mean, I don't know if they ever actually even got their computers back from that. They had to start from scratch, if memory serves me right. You know, from like some backups that they had somewhere that weren't actually at their office. But, you know, because of some of the stuff that they were doing, the government flagged them and said, you're trying to overthrow the government and we're going to investigate. We're a game company, you schmuck.
Yeah.
You know.
I can imagine Steve Jackson used literally those words, knowing him.
Yeah, so, I mean, it definitely made things interesting from that aspect. So,
oh, definitely. I just thought of something. Like, I think what literally the first post-apocalyptic game, oddly enough, is Dungeons & Dragons, like the old Blackmore setting.
Oh, in fact,
because a lot of this stuff was based on the concept, like, there was a time when D&D was more gonzo. Then you would, you know, until it got kind of repackaged and made more of a fantasy type game.
Well, you know, I can see that. I mean, especially when you take Expedition to the Barrier Peaks into account.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was about a crashed spaceship. So, mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, you look at that adventure, go like, wow. I mean, at least the published one that came out for AD&D, and you're like, huh, this is very, you know, you look at it like, that's very Gamma World-ish, without it actually being Gamma World.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, yeah, I mean, you obviously had Metamorphs Alpha before Gamma World even.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So, I'm glad you brought that up.
So, yeah, I mean, there's all these games that, you know, I think the thing about D&D is early on in D&D, we didn't have it was not as homogeneous as it is now, I think.
Oh, no, like, and every table was its own ecosystem.
I'm just saying, and I know people listening are going like, how can D&D be homogeneous? That makes no effing sense. Well, you know, it is. I mean, look at it this way. How many of us use house rules for over 50% of what we game? In D&D, that was almost the norm. You know, you would play D&D between two different groups, and two different groups wouldn't be using the same rules. You'd be mm-hmm. playing D&D at a certain level, but everyone was using house rules and alternative rules from here or there. So, while the game was called D&D, the rule sets weren't quite, you know, there was a hell of a lot more house ruling going on back when I started playing.
Which well, it was due to yourself, because you had to fill in the holes.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but it was just, that was expected. And I find it always incredible when people are like, I'm going to wait for the rules to exist for that. You know, mm-hmm. we used to just fucking make them and live with it.
Exactly. You know? And on top of that, that's one of the reasons why they were so, like, you probably had better connective tissue in what adventures you ran through, like what modules you played. And even then, that was over the basic same rule set. Because, like, again, you had the S series, you had Keep of the Borderlands, which pretty much was a lot of people's first sandbox. You had all, like, Against the Giants, you had all these epic adventures that literally defined a group. In fact, that's what 5e's been trying to do, is do the same thing. That's why they only release one or two games a year, but they try to release a hardcover that basically acts as, this is the adventure of this year, and then they cross-reference it with their community, you know, their community games.
Yeah, the Adventurers League.
Thank you, Adventurers League.
By the way, their starter set adventure, Lost Mines of Phandelver, is probably one of the best adventures I've ever run. Really great for beginners. Really robust. Just really well done. I put it right up there with Keep on the Borderlands.
That's impressive.
Mm-hmm. All right. Trying to think if there's anything else we can kind of discuss on this right now.
Yeah.
The one last thing I was going to put out there is Palladium Fantasy, I guess, but like a lot of their other games, I think they were probably the first ones to think, hey, some people might want to play the monsters, being able to play like orcs and goblins and hobgoblins and all kinds of different things. I don't know for sure if they were the first, but they've kind of touted themselves as being that.
If there is one beforehand, like, the only one that comes to mind at all, it's even RuneQuest, where you can play ducks, but... Okay. or trolls, but I would argue that in many ways it canonized a lot of the concepts of, yes, you can play monsters too, because monsters are awesome. In fact, the response to the Humanoid Handbook came out almost 6 years later, so for the I hate to keep using D&D as a kind of a guideline, but it gives you an idea of when things happen in comparison. So, yeah. No, I'm not disagreeing. And, of course, then comes both my great love and great hate of my life riffs. And it's just kind of fun just going from there.
Remember, so, everything is better with plasma.
Yeah. And dragons. Don't forget dragons.
Sorry, that was
oh, yeah, the first
one of our original hosts on the show used to always talk about that with riffs. He's like, you want a better weapon? Just add plasma. It's not just a sword. It's a plasma sword. Okay.
Well, I'm still completely convinced that the reason they named the Glitter Boy's weapon the way they did is because they watched Ash vs. Evil Dead or Armies of Darkness too many times. This is my boom gun.
Oh my god. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, but that just
so much of that game was just like this odd homage to pop culture. That it's kind of a surprise that they never got sued for some of that stuff.
Well, it's kind of funny because you're right. That's actually Palladium's game to say, besides sometimes the power fetish, is the fact they went, hey, is it cool? Yes, let's put it in. We don't care if it makes sense. And I guess you could argue D&D, especially in the early ages, had a similar zeitgeist. But that's really what brought it to the dance, is the ability to do something so insane that if you think of it for a little, it probably will break. But it don't matter because it's awesome.
Right.
All right. I think we should move on to the Kickstarters and the bundles of holding.
Sure.
So, first Kickstarter is the Game Master's Tarot. Storyteller Made Easy, which is... they're actually not doing too bad. They were only asking for roughly a little over $3,000. They're about two-thirds of the way there. You know, this is kind of one of those weird ones where I like the idea of them. But, and I do like the fact that they do have a print and play. That's kind of cool. But this is one of those ones where sometimes I'm like, I like the idea of the cards, but I wonder if, honestly, sometimes just having tables with this wouldn't have been easier. That's just me.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you there, but...
I mean, it does remind me of... Christ, what the hell was it? There was a company called Better Games at one point, and they released, I don't even know what the hell their fantasy game was, but they had three little thin booklets. One was Conrad's Fantasy, another one was like Adventure Design, the other one was like Encounter Design, and they used playing cards, and you would refer to the book for stuff. Oh no, they didn't use playing cards, they actually used tarot cards, and you would refer to this book for adventure ideas and stuff. And it's like, well, again, dice probably would have been better, but that's what this reminds me of a little bit.
Yeah, this actually is one of my... this reminds me of one of my favorite role-playing games of all time, which was a licensed game, so therefore it's no longer printed. It's the Marvel Saga system, where you played using the cards, and the cards were really well designed because they not only had a picture of whatever character it was, it had a catchphrase underneath, it had a number of value, and it had a color type. So basically, it was not unlike playing with a very stylistic version of Castle Falkenstein, which you could also use to help generate plots and so forth. Like, She-Hulk shows up giving a power questionable advantage against the Shocker. You know, and it was actually, this is what this reminds me of, only a little bit more simplified. And you're right about the table thing, because, you know, its big question is whether you want to have shiny cards or not, ultimately, when it comes to something like this.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing, though, too, is like, they have locations, encounters, and hook cards, and it's like, if you look at them, there's only 17, their standard deck, their general storytelling deck, has 17 locations, 17 encounters, 17 hook cards, and then there says there's 3 wild cards. 320. So that's actually a standard card deck, I guess. Yeah, I guess that's okay. You know, 54 cards if you count all the cards plus the two jokers. So I mean, I'm guessing they did that to keep it small. But I guess they also have a wilderness deck and a urban deck, too, is what they kind of say here. They have a general deck, and then they have those other two.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think they'll make it. I think it's an interesting idea, but I almost rather just have... Again, I'd almost rather just have, you know, use my own standard card deck with some tables.
I mean, to this day, one of my favorite games of all time is Castle Falkenstein. That uses a regular card deck.
All right, so next up we have one that I think I kind of like just because of its nature, which is the Hollowstone Forest Map Accessories, which basically to me is just pop-up terrain. That's what it looks like. It's like one of those pop-up cards. It does, doesn't it?
Oh, man. Yeah. It's got even a little things where you punch it through, you know, like, because everything's on a stand. And I don't know if I want to spend money on it, but I'm glad this product exists.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's like, I like it just for its interesting value, as I guess is what I'm going to call it. You know, interesting look.
You know what this reminds me of? Okay, the risk of dating myself, and this one's going to really date myself. There was a time at McDonald's when they used to have these maps where you actually could stick things in there. Hmm. Where they were actually part of the, you know, products they were selling. And this is the gamer equivalent of that. And honestly, it's making me grin from ear to ear.
Well, what's nice is that they have the digital copy that's only like $3 US.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a possibility you could get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you have access to a printer and some tag board, which those things are not terribly expensive, you could probably do that yourself.
Yeah. Well, the biggest thing is you got to make sure, well, for me personally, I need a gaming group that's actually local as opposed to online. Because, you know, everything, well, every time you buy something, you basically have to figure out a place to store it. Like, this is definitely going to be the 24-hour rule on this one, the more I talk about it.
Yeah, so. No, I mean, I agree. I just think it's kind of cute in its own aspect, so.
Well, again, it's great, and especially if you can figure out the gauge of what their holes are where you punch things in and out, you can basically stick it in the map and say, suddenly an ogre appears, click.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a certain group would actually get a real kick out of that, especially when you swap stuff out. And, okay, I just scrolled down, I saw their woodcutter house. I'm getting a pop-up feel now, big time.
I told you. Rising of this pop-up card.
Oh, frick.
All right, so next up we have the Bringing HLG Con to the Next Level, which is happening in Atlantic City. So if you happen to live near Atlantic City, October 12th to the 12th to the 14th. I almost said the 24th. Man, that would be a hell of a convention lasting 10 days. I don't think that could ever happen. Could you imagine a convention that was 10 days long?
Origins was 5, and that felt like too much for me.
Yeah, I'm just saying. So, obviously, they're trying to make it bigger, and so there's some pledge levels. They're only asking an additional grand. I'm not sure. I haven't really read this too much. I just thought it's cool that it's... it's for props for the LARPs. Interesting. So they have a bunch of LARPs going on, and they're looking to fund their props for the LARPs for this. That's kind of an interesting way to do it, I suppose. So if you happen to be a LARP player that wants planning to go to this convention, you may want to back it.
Yeah, and I like how the Kickstarter levels are, hey, we're going to sell you a game with a GM. I'm trying to see if, you know, I like the model and I respect what they're trying to do. And the fact that if you're in the Atlantic City area, I always recommend having, you know, doing a local con if it's you're in the area here.
Oh, I like this. This note that they have, I guess, the guy that wrote it for Harlem Unbound, he's going to be running there, Harlem Unbound.
Mm-hmm. Hey.
That's cool.
Well, dude, that's how you yeah. Just on sure principle, I hope they succeed. Just...
I think they will. I mean, they're only asking a grand. They got $805, and they still got 23 days to go. So,
and I ain't gonna lie to you.
there's one picture that's blowing me away. It's the carpeted room filled with cars.
Are we a little have a little bit of a car fetish?
Well, no, I'm just it's just the sheer absurdity because you got like four people looking under one of the cars. I don't know what that means, but I if somebody does know more, please let us know. Yeah.
All right, so next up we have the Villainous Compendium, Villains and Henchmen for Pathfinder and 5th Edition, which, hell, who doesn't need more? Henchmen are villains.
And good so, villains worth their weight in gold.
What was that?
Good villains worth their weight in gold.
Yeah. And so, you know, they've actually already reached their goal, so that's cool. I do like the fact that it's for both 5th and Pathfinder. Not that I'm playing either right now. And looks like $15. Hold on here. All right, so there's a 5th edition version and a Pathfinder version. For some reason, the Pathfinder version is $5 more.
That's weird. Well, no, I guess that makes sense.
Probably more information on the page for...
Right, like having to, I cut my teeth on 5th edition by doing conversions from Pathfinder to 5th edition. And the difference in complexity is, it's palpable. So the amount of work you would have to do to make even a henchman or a villain in Pathfinder would be many more man hours, if you will. So that I get that, I understand that.
But it's not much, it's just $5 more. That's not too bad.
Yeah. Well, I'm just more curious to see if it's for Pathfinder first, the new edition or the original system. Like,
it's going to have to be for the original because, I mean, I don't think we've really have enough about the new system yet to really...
That's true.
Some people have gotten the playtest materials so that they can bring something out on day one, I think, but I'm not 100% sure about that.
Yeah, I'm not really, you know, honestly, I'm kind of out of the loop on this one because it's like I've kind of come to the conclusion I just don't want to mess with it.
Yeah, and they actually explain why the Pathfinder version is cheaper, is more expensive than the 5th edition discount. They actually break it down into three bullet points. So at least they are explaining their math, which I give them full kudos for.
All right, let's go to the next one, which is City of Brass, Adventure for 5th Edition and Swords and Wizardry. And they actually were asking $40,000, and they got it. Wow, and they still have 22 days to go. That is impressive. I guess people didn't care for Paizo's Adventure Path, which eventually took you to the City of Brass. You know, they had one Adventure Path that eventually took you there.
Yeah, well, I think it's the name because, well, City of Brass has got to be one of the oldest names in D&D. You know, as far as encounter settings, because I remember hearing it as early, well, during the beginning of my gaming sessions. And I don't know. Like, obviously, there's a fan base, and again, it's a weird exotic environment in the middle of the elemental plane of fire if they do it right. And if that's assuming what they're doing here.
Yeah.
And it's, well, it's one of the few outer plane iconic ones that doesn't involve the outer planes in some way, shape, or form. Like, I can't think of a more iconic elemental city.
Well, I also think a lot of it has to do also with, you know, if it wasn't, I think the Arabian Tales was probably the second most, in terms of people's minds, fantasy concept.
Yeah.
You know,
and it looks like it's,
you know, I mean, let's face it. I mean, all of us, you know, growing up, it's like everyone has heard of Sinbad.
Yeah.
For example, or, you know, heard of the 100, whatever. It's 101, or is it 100? It's 100,000. It's 101 Arabian Nights.
1,001 Arabian Nights, yeah.
1,001. Yeah. I get the number. But, I mean, everyone's heard of that. So if you say that, it's like, oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Everyone's heard of Aladdin, even before the Disney movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, my personal favorite sort of Arabian Nights movie, if you will, had to be I can't think of the exact name. It was one of the, was it the Golden Voyage of Sinbad, I believe.
Is that the one with the Cyclops or the one with Kelly?
This one with Kelly.
Yes. Isn't that where Tom Baker was the villain from Doctor Who?
Tom Baker's the bad sorcerer, yeah. And of course, nice. Hey, let's not forget who else is in it, which was Carolyn Monroe, who back then she was extremely fucking hot.
I'm going to have to look for this movie.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. It's also,
Harryhausen.
Yeah, there we go. Harryhausen, stop motion animation.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. It is the classical film. It's definitely one of the best of that era. I love how on IMDb people give it a 6.8, and I'm like, really? You guys have obviously not watched it.
Any movie done by Harryhausen always goes up by a point or two in my world.
Yeah, it should.
Because, again, Kali, if you ever want to see how do you fight with multiple arms, watch the Kali fight.
Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, that was fantastic. And it's like, it's funny. I remember watching this movie before I ever saw Tom Baker as Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it wasn't even until years later, rewatching it, that I realized, hey, that's fucking Tom Baker.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Also, I was looking at the pedigree of this thing, and it looks like it's basically an updated version of the one they did for Decrementer Games back in 2006, which means this, if it's what I think it is, I think this is one of the last projects Gary ever did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously he didn't work on this obvious one because he's kind of, what's the word, dead and all, but but it's kind of amazing, like, I'll have to take a look at the original cast members, but Necromancer Game was basically where the Grognards hung out in D20 land, and they made some darn good products.
Yeah, some of their more recent things have been a little bit too dense for me. Like, what was the more recent one? What is it? Like, one of them was like a Bard's Tale or some such, like Bard's Gate, I think is what it was. And those books are just so huge and so expensive, but I'm seeing what you did about this makes me want to take a second look at it.
Well, yeah. And again, if anybody hears any of our Kickstarters and wants to tell us more, we're always available.
Yep. Oh, and one last thing. Going back to the Golden Boy and the Sinbad, I do have to say probably another film that's another one of my guilty pleasure movies that also has Carolyn in it has to be Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter.
Nice.
Nice.
What? You guys have seen it, right?
No, but I want
it. It's a classic film. Captain Kronos is played, I mean, the guy that's the actor is like some German guy, but it's hilarious. I mean, not hilarious, but I always found it was a really good film, and it's like, yeah, trust me. It's a great movie to watch. And again, she was extremely hot in that movie. I was only 3 at the time that it was made, but hell, she was still hot.
You know? That's what movies are for. Movies are for going back and seeing really cool people, really talented people, no matter what time and era you're in.
Yeah. It is possible to make a great movie on a relatively cheap cost if you have the right cast and personalities involved.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So next up, we have Pathfinder RPG Dark Fantasy Adventures Collected, levels 1 through 14. Wow. So I guess if you've had some of the Dark Adventures, you can actually get, I guess, this thing in digital format, soft cover, and hardcover formats. They were only asking $100, and they're already at $13.73, so they weren't even asking that much. Again, my recommendation, if this even interests you, probably go with the PDFs. And I only say that because, I don't know, for adventures, I find it's easier just to keep adventures, you know, it's storage-wise, with our way our digital technology is, it's easier to store it. Downside, of course, is that you can't resell it to somebody. But hey, that's one of those things.
Well, again, this is I don't know the quality of this stuff, but I always respect a decent, you know, module set where you can basically, you know, if you don't have a lot of time, slap it down, and you now have 14 levels to work with.
Exactly. All right. This one, I'm not surprised it's funded, but Grimtooth's Trapsylvania. It's a source book for Dungeon Crawl Classics, of course.
Oh, man. Like, I picked up the remake, you know, where they compiled everything from Flying Buffalo Games and they had a whole bunch of new stuff. I ain't gonna lie to you, I'm not always a fan of the DCC classics as far as material. If anything, MCC kind of showed that to me. But I'm a fan of Grimtooth and all the crazy stuff he comes up with, so it might make the cut.
Yeah, I'm almost gonna say that people have probably backed this more on the Grimtooth's name than anything else. Because
mm-hmm.
I remember, you know, early on, it's like people getting having Grimtooth's traps, and you're just like, holy fuck, really? And I remember Game Masters used to use them, and it's just like, really? It's not you versus them, you stupid.
No, it's more fun to read than actually use, because...
I know, but I'm just saying, you met people that used them, and you just wanted to bitch slap them.
I ain't gonna lie to you, this is one of the reasons I became a religious user of the 12-foot pole.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
You know, you'd be surprised. There's a reason why people of a certain gamer age, you know, you're dungeon hack.
Right.
Because if you don't, your character isn't going to live beyond first level.
Okay, so let's... we have Delve, the second edition, the dungeon exploring RPG. They actually reached their goal. They were... Well, no, they haven't. They're a little short. They're asking roughly for 13... You know, the equivalent is about $1,300. They're a little over a grand right now. I like the beginning. Shipwrecked on a beach, the adventure begins with the journey through the dark and treacherous lands of Crag Baron. Okay, I like that. Nothing wrong with being that as a start. You know, I mean, it's pretty. That's a classical trope, if you will. You're shipwrecked. Survive now. Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
And full kudos to Bruno Balexa. Like, that picture really pops for me.
Oh, the dungeon?
The one with the candles.
Oh, down below. Okay, yeah, I see it. Yeah. No, I mean, I have to... That's has some very interesting look there. So, again, if I wasn't poor, I might consider it. But I'm not doing that right now. And when I mean poor, it means I'm not allowed to spend money.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
It's not that I don't have money, I just I'm not allowed to spend money. Which is one of the reasons that I did not back obviously Champions Now, although it actually reached its goal. I was really shocked at that. I was not expecting that to happen. You know, that was one of the prior Kickstarters we covered.
I remember, yeah.
Yeah. I'm mm-hmm. It will be interesting to see if once all this is said and done, if they actually release it. You know, obviously for general purchase, and at that point I might buy it just to see, because I was very intrigued, even though maybe not, I didn't sound like it in the game, in the episode, but I was very intrigued by the direction that they were taking that game, which was, yeah, keep it simple. Yeah, you know, because Champions always got really super complicated with the point count, and there were the advice that they were giving in the playtest was basically... You probably should think twice about if that's what you're doing. You should think twice about what you're doing.
So. Mm-hmm.
All right. So next up, we have Crusades, a role-playing game. Well, who doesn't want to play in the Crusades? Well, I know a lot of people, but you know, definitely. Again, I'm a big fan of the medieval era for generalized setting. So I like the idea of. You know, not that I can condone everything that happened in the Crusades, but as a background, you know, okay, it was very unique. There was a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of stuff. There's just a wealth of material there. I mean, one, if you look at AD&D's clerics, when you read them, and if you know anything about the Crusades, they were the fighting knights of the Crusades. That's basically the cleric, the original cleric template.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anyone who doesn't think so is deluding themselves.
Oh, absolutely. Like, and again, there might be a magic goose involved. Yeah, if you know your history, like one of the first Crusades was led by a hermit with a magic goose. Back the one of the first before all the knights showed up.
Oh,
still
God.
Ugly, still horrific, but still kind of funny when you think about it.
Yeah. God, what I'm trying to think of that movie with. shoot.
Oh, you mean the one with the siege? Yeah, I know which one you're talking about. I just can't remember the name.
The siege? You mean like the
cape? Something kingdom.
Oh.
Kingdom of something. Epic? Yeah, that's the one. That movie will put you in the mood for a good a Crusades game.
Yeah. And there's other movies that take place around the Crusades or people who mm-hmm. were crusading knights. I'm thinking of like there's like a I think it's dubbed Arn. It's like who's that? ARN.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a foreign film, at least from the America standpoint, and that was pretty good.
Oh, absolutely.
So there's just a lot of stuff. And hell, we can't. We would be remiss and not mention, you know, obviously Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. So because I mean, in a transcendental way, it obviously involves the Crusades.
Well, definitely. It's basically a lot more black and white than the original Crusades. I'm just saying. I have definite opinions.
All right. So, second to last, we have The Angry GM, the website, the book.
Yeah, full confession. I read back this one.
Yeah. It definitely reached its goal. So you can't argue with that. I mean, $15 for a bunch of game mastering device. Everybody needs game mastering advice, even all of us who've lived or gamed for a long time.
Yeah, he's got a really good style, both funny and well-informative when it comes to his presentation. Yeah. So
and sometimes we just need to be reminded of things. I know I do. You're like, oh, yeah, that's right, I should do that. So if you need advice, look no further. And last up, we obviously have Iron Gate, Savage World Sci-Fi Expansion for the Last Parsec, which is a basically plot point campaign taking place on a prison planet. Yeah, Iron Gate is an intergalactic prison planet populated by a melting pot of the worst criminals the galaxy has to offer. Left to their own devices, the inmates have created a culture of violence, greed, and profit. And there is profit to be made. Built on top of a former mining colony, the prison operates its own mine.
Now, my big question is it measured in parsecs?
No, I think it's just the planet. It says, as long as the prisoners produce ore, Jump Corps supplies the inhabitants with food, medicine, and goods they can't get on the barren planet themselves. But something has gone wrong. Lately, prisoners are escaping. Can your Jump Corps CorpSec team infiltrate one of the planet's most ruthless gangs and discover how they're performing this impossible feat?
Yeah, I'm getting a real Riddick vibe from this as well.
I was going to say that almost sounds like Escape from New York.
Yeah, I know. Planet. It's like I'm getting a couple of different vibes off this. I'm getting that. I'm getting, obviously, Riddick. I'm getting Soldier.
Yep.
You know? Yeah.
My cheesy Star Wars comment refers to the Spice Mines of Kessel.
Yeah. So, I'm just saying, there's a lot going on here. So, they've already reached their goal. Again, I'm going to have to file for charity, because I am not affording this right now.
And then the 24-hour rule for a reason.
Well, I can't afford it. So, again, that's fair. Very cool. I wish I could. So last
sometimes
up, we need to cover the bundle of holding.
Yep.
Oh, did you have a comment there, Ish?
Oh, no, I was just going to say sometimes if there's one that I really, really want and I can't afford, I'll just go in for $1 and hope they have like a late backer or something like where you can come in later or whatever.
Yeah, sometimes they do that. And sometimes I just go like, well, I can't back it now, but hopefully if it's like obviously something like Savage Worlds, they're going to have it on their website later.
Yeah. Yeah, must do.
So first up, we have one of my people that I've talked to in the past. He has his bundle of holding for Colonial Gothic, which I've always liked the idea of, but I've never played. Either one of you guys familiar with Colonial Gothic?
Mm-mm.
No, but that's the game that I've really been intrigued by. I'd like to try once.
Yeah. Basically, the idea, it's by Rogue Games. And I don't remember if it still uses what used to be called the 12-degree system or not. I can't remember. Things like what was the damn fantasy game called? It was kind of a something sword and spell. I don't remember. But anyway, what was it?
Oh, no, I'm just trying to figure it out myself.
It was kind of the same system that Thousand Suns used to use. You know, there was a split at some point. So, but anyway, Colonial Gothic. So you can get the basic rules system with some other things for just a little under $8. And if you go up to almost $18, you what is it? Hold on. Which started? Oh, it now stands at 1823. All right, it's where it is now. So if you bump it up some, you can get the bonus collection of material, which includes a whole bunch of other stuff. I've always liked this idea of like this secret war that happened during the Civil War. You know, this mystic war, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it kind of, in some ways, Colonial Gothic came out way before that Sleepy Hollow TV series came out.
Well, oh yeah, this could be argued as one of the games that you said was before its time.
Oh yeah. I mean, I've always liked the idea of a colonial setting or a pre-colonial setting. I mean, there are certain things I know my current fiance would argue she does not care for, mm-hmm. just due to the nature. But thing, you know, movies like Last of the Mohicans, you know, the newer version that came out. You know, I always liked the idea of that, you know, where it's like, okay, I always thought it would be interesting if you could properly do a fantasy setting where, you know, you have people from the old world coming to the new world.
Yeah.
You know, and the interactions you would have therefore in. I always thought that would be an interesting concept for a fantasy game because, you know, you could have people come over and that you could have some of these old world people coming, dealing with the new world cultures, and there obviously would be adventures and other things involved in the new world cultures. That might be some interesting interactions, but I never really could figure a good way to do it that wasn't derivative or bad.
Yeah, that's fair. And also you can explain why a more exciting reason than the real reason why there's a eye with a pyramid with an eye on it on the back of the $1 bill.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't. All right, so next up we do have Mutant and Masterminds, superpowered by M&M3 Third Edition. Mm-hmm. It's weird because it's just supplements. So it's not actually the Mutant and Masterminds rulebook, but it's all supplements. So if you have some gaps in your supplements, this might be something for you. Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot to say, Colonial Gothic. Their donation is for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Okay, I give them full kudos for that one.
So, and then let's go back to Superpowered by Mutant and Masterminds. They are doing the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is very popular. And then last up for this, what was that?
Yeah. Oh, I just read what they were actually about, and that's good charity.
And last up, we have Eclipse Phase, which again is supplements for Eclipse Phase.
Mm-hmm.
There's still 6 days to go on that. Oh, they actually also do have the other Eclipse Phase, which is about 6 days. So there's two different Kickstarters. There's Eclipse Phase and there's Eclipse Phase Plus 2. One has the rule book. One has a bunch of supplements. In both cases, I think they're doing the electronics. Frontier Foundation, again, like I said, very popular to do. That's really it, because we already mentioned the Delta Green in the previous one, and it's actually ending here shortly, so.
Yeah.
Wow. Did we actually get through the episode?
I think so.
Wow. That was quite a thing. You know, for not having that many Kickstarters, because this is actually a short list. We actually ran this episode pretty good. If I do say so myself. So if there's anything you'd like to tell us, if you have any comments, you can send me an email at info@rpgcircus.com. You can go to our Facebook page. When I post the episode, leave me a comment there. I do try to answer them. If you leave a comment on the website, I do try to answer those as well. That said, I'm going to try to, between episodes, post a little bit more on Facebook just to kind of keep us out there, because I used something called Friends Plus Me to kind of, anytime I did a post on Google Plus, it would post on Google Plus, on Twitter, and Facebook. I found that a little annoying after a while, and I really wasn't posting a lot. Plus, the links on Facebook would shove you to the Google Plus post, if that makes any sense, which was annoying too. It wasn't a copy. It was just like, yeah, here's a pointer to the Google Plus post that you just said. Well, that's fucking annoying for people. So I'm just going to start doing most of the stuff via Facebook. I don't think we really have... If another listener wants to prove me wrong, please let me know. But I didn't think we get a lot of hits from Twitter or Google Plus anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Any closing comments from either one of you guys? Or are we good?
No, I think we're good.
Well, all right. Only thing I'll say is our usual thing. Basically, if we got anything wrong, let us know. If there's anything you thought we should have brought up in our concerts, let us know. And if you were there, let us know.
And even if you weren't there, I don't care. Let us know, too.
Exactly.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.